This podcast is presented by Hannover Messe, your leading event for industrial AI.
Hi there, welcome to a new episode of the Industrial AI Podcast. My name is Peter Seeberg and I'm your host. My guest today is Mehmet Mercangöz. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Mehmet is the ABB reader in autonomous industrial systems at the Department of Chemical Engineering at the Imperial College London. And Mehmet and I today are going to be talking about AI and autonomous systems in process industry. Hello, Mehmet.
Hello, Peter. Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. How was my pronunciation of your family name?
That was pretty okay.
Very good. So, Mehmet, please introduce yourself to our Industrial AI podcast listeners.
Yes. So you already mentioned I'm a reader, what is translating to something like an associate professor in more well-known terms of academic titles at the Department of Chemical Engineering, where I teach and I do research. So among other things, I teach our final year students how to design industrial control and safety systems. And as for my research, I'm leading a team of PhD students and postdoctoral researchers working on autonomous industrial systems. Before joining Imperial, I spent about 14 years working for ABB in Switzerland, where I held various R&D roles in systems engineering, control, and optimization. And I guess my work on autonomous systems is what brings us here together.
Exactly. As I was preparing, I looked at, actually, it was one of your false beliefs, Imperial College London. I wasn't aware, but when I looked, because you had this image south of Hyde Park, right, Kensington, and the reason I say so, it's in the direct vicinity, right, of Harrods. I saw that there's a Princess Diana Memorial there as well. I wasn't aware because the reason I say so, that during the 90s, I spent considerable time around that area. It was related to Intel, and I had very good memories, actually, having numerous walks in the park. And you are based exactly south of the park, I believe, right?
This is correct. Yes, yes.
That's not what we're talking about today. We're talking about AI and autonomous systems in process industry. Let's maybe start, and some of the listeners may recall that I've actually done this before, but let's talk about what is process different from the classification I typically do, discrete manufacturing.
Yes. So these are two fundamentally different ways in which we produce things, we make things. And I think if you think of glue that we use to stick things together and how glue is made versus perhaps how a cell phone is made. So the kind of things like glue we make in the process industry, which are not countable. It's not one cell phone, two cell phones. It's more like a bucket of glue, two buckets of glue, right? So this is different. And then it's also, I guess, a key thing I want to give here this as an example is you can't stop, let's say, if one machine is not working right in a cell phone manufacturing line, you can just stop everything and you can go troubleshoot, figure out why was it not working. And then go back to where you started and pick up production. You could also say, okay, you stopped your shifts and you're going to switch off the lights and send the workers home. And then they can come back and again start from where they left. But if you're making glue, this is not so straightforward, right? If your vessels, your tanks are full of glue, you can't just stop this because then you might need to come back with a jackhammer actually to clean things up, right? So this is actually a big difference. So what this means is in the process industry, if we start things, it's not so easy to stop. And if we stop things, it's also not so easy to start again. And the kind of things we do, we handle gases, liquids, things that typically flow in these flowing environments rather than on machines that drill holes or they do CNC manipulation on some solids. So these are fundamentally different. And also from a point of view of control systems, right, within the context of autonomous system, greater autonomous systems topic, the type of controls you will find in the two environments, manufacturing environments, are quite different. In the process industries, we need to use a lot of feedback control because there is a lot of uncertainty, a lot of disturbances. Whereas in the manufacturing side of things, in discrete manufacturing, what you will have is more open loop procedural automation systems. So something comes, something is detected, a hole is drilled, and it moves to the next station type things. So this is also a rather big difference, because when it comes to mechanical work, so what workers do, traditionally, since perhaps the 60s, 70s, these continuous process plants have been requiring less labor, less mechanical labor compared to traditional manufacturing. So these systems are really, you start it and you watch it. So it's more the control, observation, something leaking and so on is more the challenge. Whereas in discrete manufacturing, there has been quite a bit of humans putting things together, which of course led to also an interest of robots, right? So you might find a lot of robots today that are replacing this kind of manual work in these discrete manufacturing installations, but not so much in a continuous process plant, because you don't need these robots as it is for normal operation.
So when we talk about autonomous later on, then we have a different starting point, so to say, from, you know, a process in relation to discrete.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also, again, the way things work, or the pain points when it comes to labor, perhaps, is with discrete manufacturing, it used to be the case that there is always a new product coming up, the next year's model coming up. And this requires then quickly changing the manufacturing setup. So this reconfiguration and reorganizing of the whole manufacturing machine had been a challenge. And this also drove the development of, for example, the programmable logic controllers by the automotive industry. So that's how they drove the automation, because they needed this flexible automation environments. Whereas for the process plants, when we build them, they continue making glue or sulfuric acid or fertilizers and so on for very long periods of time. They don't need to make the next year's fertilizers, let's say.
Exactly right. I recall from my last job before I became an individual contributor consultant, it was at Softing, and actually I was a market segment manager, and I was in charge of the discrete and Thomas Hills. Thomas, if you're listening, regards from me here right now. You were in charge of process, and Thomas and I, we made the border between discrete and process. I believe it was typically the bottling of, let's say, could be Coca-Cola or water, or maybe you could say the same thing. And thank you very much for giving the additional information regarding the glue. So putting the glue in some kind of whatever bottle, or I'm not sure where you put it in. So, and that's where I recall as well that, you know, the process plant would typically be designed to live for what, 30, 40 years, when discrete maybe sometimes is more like 4 years and you produce a new production line, right? Good. Next thing, before we then go in, let's clarify what autonomy is. You know, how would you define autonomy before we then say, you know, and what do we want to do with autonomy?
Yes. So autonomy a buzzword, or how should we treat autonomy? I think if you think about the origins of the word, if I remember it correctly, it literally translates to self-rule or self-law in Greek. So auto is self, and nomi, I think, are rules. So it's really about the ability to self-rule. And I think if you now make a connection to what we might be talking about as autonomy, we say self-driving cars. So that self part is really in there, right? So if you're talking about autonomous cars, so there's some, the meanings are not so far apart. But in the context of this podcast, I'll say for industrial AI, I'm referring really to machines doing industrial jobs on their own without needing humans to do some of the involved jobs. So I think this is a very, very concise, very practical definition in some way. And I think we can later also talk if there's a need to extend this further, because there is a lot of, let's say, extensions on this. One is, like you were mentioning, a demarcation between continuous and discrete plants. So people are also trying to create a demarcation between what is automation and what is autonomy. And so there are some attempts to try to define autonomy more clearly. But in my opinion, actually, it is just from the outside, if you're looking at it, is it an automated plant or is it an autonomous plant? So as long as it's doing its job, you could say it's the same thing. But when you look at the details and the nuances, typically what comes up is that automation is more pre-programmed, is only designed to handle fixed things. Like you always get the same part and you drill a hole in the bottom left corner and always repeating. Versus if you get something that's an odd shape and the machine needs to decide actually where it should drill the hole, right? So these kind of advances, or when you start using AI algorithms instead of basic control rules, then perhaps you say, okay, now we are venturing into autonomous systems from automation. But I mean, these we can discuss depending on how you would like to take it, yeah.
Right. Well, what I've typically been saying, and it is then typically related to more the philosophical, not, well, before that, it's like when we get into autonomous weapons, right? And then people are really scared. And my point has always been, weapons, or machines, we'll talk about that today, plants, autonomous from the point where the human has, clicked a button, so to say, put the production line, the process line into an autonomous state. And same thing with weapons, which we're not talking about today. Always say, machines or weapons or whatever, they cannot decide to not go to work today, to not do what they're supposed to do. A human needs to initiate. That's for me, but that's what I'm interested in your view on that. The human needs to put something into motion, so to say, push a button, the famous red button, if we talk about weapons, which we don't want to really get into. And then from a state of autonomy, then we say, okay, now the machine, the plant, the whatever, the car is autonomous, as you say, is self-ruling.
Yes, right. I mean, I think this self-rule is quite a scary concept. So we really don't want that, right? I mean, we want these machines really to work for us. I mean, we don't want them to start doing the things that they want to. So which also actually brings up an important aspect, because we want these machines to do what we want, right? So at least there has to be one interface, like you said, okay, put it in autonomous mode, or a passenger getting into a driverless car saying, okay, I want to go to point B from where we are from point A. So at least there has to be that interaction where we tell these machines, okay, what we would like them to do. But I think maybe we will touch it again later, is I envision there will be also more touch points. So this doesn't mean that an autonomous system works in isolation without any humans. So in various settings, it could very well be that you have a collaborative setting, that you have a truly autonomous system that is doing its own job. But this job is somehow related to the job of someone else next door, which is a human being, actually, or a human being perhaps assisted by some kind of AI technology. But nevertheless, we need to handle also those interactions. So it's really, it's not that autonomous system doesn't mean no humans, not necessarily.
Very good. Yes, we will talk about that. So then next thing, going into the topic, why at all, and you kind of maybe made already a suggestion, why at all would we then be interested in autonomous industrial systems?
Yes. So I think maybe looking at it from the perspective of the process plants, right? I said I'm working on process systems. So it's chemical engineering, right? So and I don't want to make it look like a selfish point, but what we are making in these process industries are really critical for the functioning of the modern civilization. So it's not really the newest sport car or the newest cell phone. So we are talking about really making fertilizers, medicine, food. So modern society really needs these process plants to function. And luckily, when we had the COVID-19 pandemic, we didn't need to worry about these plants functioning, because we already had a pretty good basis of automation where a smaller core crew could actually go to these plants and keep them operational. So we didn't have to suffer from these plants not running. But it appears that we are moving towards a future where employment preferences are changing. We also have a demographic shift, particularly in the developed countries. And these countries, I think, are now also including countries like China, where the demographics are shifting towards an aging population. So that core crew where you have these expert operators and so on, are retiring, and we don't have as many young people who are interested in actually going and working in these installations. Sometimes these are remote installations. Maybe it's not attractive. So there are various reasons we see this students not studying as much engineering or technical jobs. So we have actually an acute risk. If we don't tackle this, we might find ourselves in a position where we don't have any more those core crews or in the same numbers as we do today that can really operate these plants, making these really important ingredients for our society to function. So that's why we need to find ways of being able to run these industrial plants without relying as much as we do today on human input. So that's one reason why I say why autonomous industrial systems. There are two other, I'll say, important points. So the first one out of these is also the reason why perhaps I'm funded to do this research and why industry is so interested. And it is really about improving efficiency. So there are industries looking into autonomous technologies as a way to build better systems. So in process industries, typically people point out that operator error is a major source of outage, unplanned outages. And an unplanned outage in the type of plant that I mentioned, right? You cannot stop it when you want, or you cannot start it as easily if you stopped it. It means that if you have an outage, you actually have a plant not running for some time. And that means a very large capital investment that was made is not actually earning money, standing still. So this is very undesirable. So now these companies are looking into autonomous systems as artificial intelligent operators, which won't make the same mistakes that our operators do. So this can be perhaps unjustified, actually, position for operators, because most of the time you say operator error, but it's actually due to the way things were set up. There was an alarm missing, or because the operator was tired, and maybe the way the screens were set up. So it was not thought out about how that was going to go. And then operator makes a mistake. I mean, you might have seen the Chernobyl show, right? In some years ago, there was this very, very interesting show.
Something similar, yeah. Right.
So it's a very, very clear case of operator error leading to disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, we say wherever people work, you know, mistakes, errors are being made. I think what you're saying is like, if the error is being made by the operator in a plant, it's, you know, a huge, huge impact. That's maybe a difference, right?
Indeed. So this is perhaps also some similarities with self-driving cars. So there is hope that self-driving cars will reduce the accidents, the road accidents that we have. And is this going to be the case? I believe that it's going to be the case. In the end, these machines, they have their attention span that doesn't depend on personal issues or being tired or not. So it's extremely consistent. And if also with advances in artificial intelligence, which can then be infused into these systems, you can also say they will be smarter. So they'll take smarter decisions, which will then lead to improved productivity, reduced waste, and reduced energy consumption. And so that's the reason why industry is looking today at autonomous systems, perhaps not as much as this shortage of labor, which I think also will be important. The very last thing I want to discuss, though, which I think is also interesting, or why I'm also working on these topics, is that, so in addition to really saving the world, if we had a pandemic and so that we can keep our nice things coming along from autonomous factories, I'm also doing actually this work because I believe the kind of technologies we are developing will actually reduce the entry barrier for advanced solutions. So these intelligent solutions that today the big companies, the companies with the financial means to invest, have access to complex optimization solutions, intelligent control solutions, and so on. Today, these solutions are extremely engineering heavy. So in order to get them done, you really need to put in quite a chunk of money to get started for saving energy, for improving your production, and so on. And this dependence on engineering efforts is also another aspect, because we also have lots of engineers that are taking care of the automation systems that we have today. So if you think about, if we go autonomous, we also should perhaps reduce our reliance on these human engineers as well. And if we could do that, that would also mean that with reduced engineering effort, these intelligent solutions will become more accessible to smaller companies. So companies perhaps in countries where maybe their margins are not the same, maybe their access to talent is not the same. So they cannot reach the same level of operational excellence as their peers in other places with other financial means can. So this is moving along. Perhaps you have also heard this democratization of AI type topics. So this is really the democratization of advanced control solutions.
We'll come to that later, I think. Maybe we'll talk about generative AI in the area of engineering, for example, in the design phase. I think we'll come to that in a moment. Yeah, very good. Very good overview. And I strongly agree in all of them. The one that I can confirm is like, yeah, we don't have. I mean, you gave the example of the UK, I believe, 1 million vacancies. I think we have it all over Europe, at least that I know, everywhere. We don't have young people, not enough young people. And if we want to continue to produce or maybe even get production back to wherever it is that we don't have the people, plus the additional reasons that you gave. Now, do autonomous systems plans already exist today, the first ones maybe, or are we still far away? Can you give an example or two?
Yes, I think we have autonomous systems already today, at least in the process industries. But maybe it's again important to highlight this because of the whole life cycle aspects, right? So if you think of a plant from being built to operated to decommissioned and so on. So throughout this, it's very difficult to say, okay, this is fully autonomous and nothing's happened. So this is difficult, but we could really talk about operating for long periods of time, perhaps weeks, months, without having any human intervention. And this also doesn't need to involve, let's say, humans can be in supervisory mode as long as they are not interfering. If they haven't interfered, we can claim that, okay, we reached autonomy. And we do have such systems already. One example, a popular example, is air separation plants. So we might need, for example, a plant might need nitrogen. And this nitrogen you take from the air typically. Yeah? You separate air to purify it. So you have this big machine that sucks in air, then does things to it, and then uses some energy, and then actually can give you out of a pipe nitrogen. And so plants like these air separation plants, had been running without human operator intervention for some time. And I guess we might come to it later too, because these plants are relatively straightforward. They're not complex. And they're dealing always with the same air. So there is no air from supplier A and supplier B, and then you need to adjust to things because supplier B's air doesn't have as much nitrogen. This doesn't happen. So that's why they can actually manage this. And there are also a few other examples. I like one example from Shell. They claim their Groningen gas field had been running under the supervision of two remote operators, where they are for very long periods are not interfering with operations. They're in supervisory mode. So they were giving this as an example. So I think we are seeing examples of autonomous systems. But one also needs to be careful here. So because we are also seeing claims of autonomous operation, which are by some vendors, which are, if they have deployed, let's say, artificial intelligence-based solution, they like to associate that with autonomy without really looking into, is there another human involved? You know, what is the overall, you know, scope of this? Where does it start? Where does it end? So I think we see some claims, which I will say, okay, this is another advanced solution. It's not necessarily actually something that enables autonomy beyond what we were able to do before. So that's something I would also like to say.
Okay, very good. So if we talk about, you know, making plants autonomous, maybe we want to look at what is or what has been the role of the human in the process plant. And then the related question is, will autonomy then take over at all the different stages of the life cycle of a process plant?
Yes. So I touched on this briefly. I was mentioning that the process plants have been running without many laborers on site. So this has been, let's say, the case since quite some time. But of course, this also depends on the size of the facility. So I guess if you were to go to the Ludwigshafen plant of BASF, I think you will see many people also in there doing working like ants as well. But before coming to that, if you take a typical process plant, the core operational concept that has developed over the years is a three-layer system. You know, so we have the first layer is we have automatic control loops. So we have these feedback controllers that you might have also seen or that engineers learn about in their undergraduate studies. So we have these feedback controllers that try to keep things within the limits where you want them to be. But then you have human operators. So when these variables, let's say, deviate beyond the ranges you want them to be, you have alarms. And you the idea is to have these human operators to respond to these alarms. And this is when actually things are perhaps not going according to plan. So this is when operators really start getting involved. And in a well-functioning plant, operators might be idle for very long periods. But when indeed some things go wrong, they scramble to action and they try to take care of it. And if they cannot handle it, so if those values deviate beyond the, let's say, a secondary level of thresholds, where we initiate some actual safety functions. And then those safety functions are intended to bring the system back to a safe state, shut it down perhaps. And this is how chemical plants operate today or process plants operate today. So it's really these three tiers. And it's the operators which bridge these two layers of automated systems. And they take care of things by taking manual action, by really deciding on what to do. So this is a key dependence on humans as far as running these plants go. So it's also quite common that these operators will tour facilities. So they will look for leaks. They will look for perhaps smoke, fire, vibrations, so something coming out of the machines. Perhaps not so straightforward to pick up from where they're sitting in the control room. And sometimes you also might have some lab operation going on because I mentioned glue, right? So you want to check the quality. So that might require things that an inline sensor might not be able to tell you. So you might need to take some samples and do laboratory analysis. So it's also quite typical to have also maybe a small laboratory that accompanies a process plant. So this is the, let's say, day-to-day operation. So you don't have, besides this, too much going on as far as humans are involved. But then there is always some continuous improvement. So perhaps at a frequency, not as the daily, hourly, 24-hour shift type thing, we also have engineers. So they look at, for example, about tuning controllers or if there is like a model-based system, a digital twin type thing. So they might be tinkering with it to keep it up to date. And also they have to do plans, for example, which unit will be maintained when and what's our plan for revamping perhaps certain things. So these are also being done. And when things go wrong, so you also will have some multipurpose teams, mechanical, electrical teams that will respond to fix things. So quite often we have redundant items like pumps. These are troublesome units. That's why we tend to put two of them typically on every line, wherever we need them. So there is always a spare pump. And then if needed, if the pump is acting up, they could actually take the spare one into operation and go into fixing, servicing the unit that was acting up. So general troubleshooting and so on, which I think actually is notable because I think this is quite a tricky task, which is super multipurpose, requires a lot of actually hand-eye coordination, very flexible and, you know, manipulation of things. And yeah, you can have IT, OT teams that are also taking care of the control systems, the computer communication systems that you might have. You also have, if this is a facility with road access, which is typically the case unless you're talking about an oil platform type thing. So you also have then perhaps some security manning the gates and responding to things.
Yeah. Right. So where I wanted to go at is like, I don't know if you want to, you know, break it down, like the different kind of activities, maybe manipulation, perception, cognition. What is, where in all these examples that you gave, where do you see that over the next, you know, whatever, 5-10 years, whenever it's going to be, where do you see, you know, it's going to be relatively easy or not that difficult, or where it's going to be almost Is there going to be an area where you say, well, not for the next 10 years, can we easily take over from what today the human is doing?
There is a lot of appetite and there is a lot of interest, actually, to indeed do more and more of these things that I mentioned, either remotely or with fewer people. So, and some of them, I mentioned that operators tour the facilities to look for leaks or look for plumes or look for vibration. So, you could also imagine a mobile sensing platform like a robot dog that's actually walking around it.
Or a drone, right?
Or a drone, yes.
I've seen videos of a drone over a process plant, I believe, yeah. And so the person is sitting somewhere else in the world, I guess, and sees the imagery. Or then, you know, talking about what is in the role of AI. I mean, the person doesn't have to look 24 hours kind of drone images. So is there going to be, as an example, some kind of visionary AI recognizing this is a potential problem, so the person only needs to look at those 5 minutes of the 24 hours?
Yes, I actually see this as a somewhat of a solved problem. It's only a matter of coming up with the right products and only a matter of economic sense. So I think if this really is making economic sense, I think we will see these being deployed. So there is no question, because we are seeing tremendous advances when it comes to characterizing images or even hyperspectral images and so on, which can detect really such issues, or even acoustic cameras that can detect leaks and in the plant. So I think this type of touring the facilities type job, I think is going to be possible to do with machines. I think it's already possible today. It's, the question is it possible economically? Is it economically feasible to do it? And so that's feasible. But then, yeah, perception, like I said, I said the pump might need to be serviced, right? So if you think about the pump being serviced, so there is a lot of actually hand-eye coordination, observation, where is the rust, and, you know, maybe to scratch it a bit and so on. So this brings up then to, I said you don't find many robots in process plants, but in the future, it could be that you can say, okay, we can have a robot that's doing a similar job. There, I'm a little hesitant. So I think the things that today the mechanics or electrical technicians are doing is quite complex for a single machine to do. So you might need really many actuators, many manipulators on these robots, you know, jack of all trades, everything, which can then increase the cost and also sometimes the payload of moving. So if you have two people there, they can actually move a pump. But maybe if you want to do the same with a robot, you need actually a much more stronger, perhaps, with a, you know, fixed basis kind of thing, which then increases the cost pretty strongly. So I see both economic but also technical challenges today. I find this fascinating, that how fast the developments in AI are able to do things that we tend to do with our brains. So it seems like AI is getting pretty good at doing things that we do with our brains. But these fine hand-eye coordination manipulation seems to be actually turning out to be more challenging for various reasons.
Is it the Moravec paradox? Is that how it's called?
So it could very well, I should read about it, because I find it fascinating, I must say. Because it's also for arrogant humans that are proud of their intelligent brains. These developments are interesting.
Yeah, I saw this video yesterday with Jan LeCunha. I think he referred to it. I think it's Moravec, I don't know, where AI typically does things, you know, like playing chess or calculation, but doing the things that we humans take for granted, you know, standing up, walking, whatever. So that, I believe it's called the Moravec paradox, yeah. So you referred in the beginning to complexity. So how is that relation between autonomy, complexity? What can you say? I mean, maybe there's a logical thing for me to think that, oh, the more complex the plan is going to be, the more difficult, or not. Maybe it's the other way around. The more complex, maybe AI is going to, what can you share with us in that relationship between complexity of a plant and the potential of autonomy?
Yes, I think the more complex plant is more difficult to make autonomous. So that was my position on that. And I must say, I mean, the reason I also bring that up is this complexity sometimes is unavoidable, but sometimes it's a choice. So we actually decide to build complex plants because they are more efficient, or they cost less, or let's say the product they will produce will cost less because we created a huge connection of things which are very efficient, but also highly complex to troubleshoot or to fix. So I think the reason I bring up complexity, and complexity can emerge in different ways. So I claim there is a design element. So the more integration, the more, for example, energy recovery, the more material recovery we start putting into a plant, then we increase complexity. Or if we use, let's say, not much redundancy, then we are also increasing complexity. If we use limited storage, we are increasing complexity. So these are design choices, which makes things more difficult when it comes to operation. But also you could say that if you are buying, let's say, your feedstock from 5 different sources, all of which are from different places around the world with big variations, each time you have a switch, you will have a difficult job in really getting things right. And then finally, you have other interfaces. With the energy transition, we are looking, for example, into connecting these process plants more intimately with the power grid to utilize renewable electricity. So this is also going to be a source of complexity because the power grid behavior will be not as constant. I mean, there will be variations, or the plants need to perhaps adapt to cases where maybe energy is not as available or is more available, so they can utilize that. So these are all reasons why complexity will increase. The reason I'm bringing this up in my work is to highlight that autonomy perhaps is not only about looking into how can we improve algorithms. It could also be possible by reducing complexity. So if we build a next generation plant, if we have autonomy in mind, maybe we can make some design choices which incur penalties when it comes to perhaps efficiency to a certain extent, but in the end is more amenable to building an autonomous system out of it. So this is, I think, an important point, and I believe that this will come also in the future as we see a change of types of plants, which again, because of the energy transition, I think we will see this because we need to actually change the way we operate. We depend heavily in these process plants on fossil fuels. And when we change, this also gives an opportunity actually to rethink perhaps how we handle this complexity and how we can make things more autonomous.
Final topic related, building on top of, is I read the batch, Andrew Wang, maybe you know him, deep learning, and he talks about autonomous agents, or he talks about LLM-based agents that autonomously plan, execute sequences. And why I bring it up is that he has somewhere, he says, you know, it's cheap to fetch a web page. And if your agent chooses poorly and reads the wrong page, there's little harm done. But in comparison, sending a product or moving a physical robot, we're moving into our area, there are costly actions, which makes it hard to experiment. So he says there's a big development. My question to you is, do you see agents, autonomous agents, in your area, in process plants, doing already a job, or will they be a part of making the plant autonomous?
I think this depends to a certain extent on the definition of the agent or what we understand of an agent, but I think so, because one thing is I expect that we will tackle this problem by breaking a big problem into smaller chunks and assigning expert agents, let's say, that are okay, perhaps I should use also the word expert carefully here. It's specialized agents that are tackling those specific jobs. And as I was mentioning, it is easier to define autonomy if we say, okay, this task is being done by this agent and it doesn't need human supervision. It's actually also simpler to say, okay, this is not autonomous and this is not. And the approach that we use to deploy control systems, and the control system environments are called distributed control systems also for process plants. And even though some might say, okay, these are actually monolithic centralized systems, the way we realize this are we have these controllers actually, and the control loops and so on are control loops which can run on their own. And I think this also is a good hint that building distributed systems, agents that are together tackling issues. For example, you can think of an agent that's a controller tuning agent, or you can think of an agent that is a flame detection agent, some are fire detection agent, right? So it's, and when you combine them all together, they will be doing the job that, that we have operators doing today. So that, that's why I also, I think this approach of agents is the right way. I also, whenever we are using a machine learning algorithm or AI algorithm as part of these, I like to refer to them as the agent. And I think that's a good way to also maybe make the distinction what we are trying to do here.
Okay, thank you. Coming to a close, we need to tell us a little bit more about your autonomous industrial systems lab, as I believe it's called, at the Imperial College. And I believe you also have the Sargent Center for PSE Process System Engineering. What is it that you do and what listeners might be interested in? What, you know, are they typically maybe bachelor, master, PhD students or?
So Sargent Center for Process Systems Engineering is one of the well-known and also one of the largest group of process systems engineers coming together. And here, there the keyword is systems, really. And we really need to look at things in the wider scale of how they connect, how are the interface, how can we model, how can we optimize, actually, the way they work. So it's beyond autonomy, in that case, all the academics working in Sargent Center or associated with Sargent Center, they look at many different things from design of molecules, even not only the design of plants, all the way to designing supply chains or optimizing supply chains so that we have more resilient structures. In my research lab, so which we call Autonomous Industrial Systems Lab, what are we doing? So we are working on developing new methods which can be used for building these kind of autonomous agents that we spoke about. Our focus is primarily on decision-making applications. So really where the agents actually implement actions on plants, not just, you know, making some analysis. This is really, we are looking into closing the loop. So one track we have there is on what we call safe optimization. So in the automation layer, we have a layer which we call real-time optimization that picks operating points for these process plants. So we are trying to build agents which can actually make these decisions completely on their own by probing the plant. And we are, this case really, it's not a simulation. They can work on the real plant and collect information as they also optimize. And we want to make sure that this process happens in a safe way. So we are trying to build these approaches where we can enforce constraints with a certain probability and looking into things of how we can reduce the computational demands of such methods, because you need to keep building, retraining machine learning models, and also how we can infuse existing engineering knowledge into such algorithms. So that's one track we have for research. Another track we have is on adversarial optimization. So here we are trying to use adversarial methods for, again, picking operating points which are more tolerant to things going wrong. So in the end, really ties into how can we make these intelligent systems more dependable, more safe? Because, I mean, that's going to be the biggest hurdle to convince really the end users to say, look, this approach will be a safe approach, it's a trustworthy approach. So these are things how we are trying to address. And along with this, we are trying to build training and test environments for collaborative systems. I think this can be something interesting. If you think of autonomous driving applications, there, when they are training, testing their algorithms, they have to represent cars driven by human drivers. So they have to have cars because they have to do the case where their autonomous car is approaching an intersection, it's going to make a left turn, and there are cars driven by humans. And in a simulation, they are doing this. So in the simulation, they have to find a way to represent how a real human being is going to do the driving. And I mentioned we might have this collaborative case where one autonomous algorithm might be working alongside some human operator. So in this case, again, if you want to build a similar simulation environment, we need to simulate how the human operator actually behaves. So here, for example, we have used stochastic finite state machines to capture how actually a human operator might react to situations. And we are really trying to capture this partial unpredictability of how the human might be reacting. So if we then use this to train intelligent agents, they will know how to recognize what is actually the human doing or what should I expect the human to do. So these are the kind of things we are looking at. And finally, you were mentioning LLMs. This is also one of our upcoming projects. We want to see how we can actually put these LLMs into decision-making loops, if they can be used really to process heterogeneous information to come up with ways of solving puzzles. Okay, do I turn this off and do I start this other unit? How do I actually shut something down? So these kind of stage-wise decisions are really not as straightforward to do with our traditional approaches for automatic control. So there I see great potential in how this can actually be integrated.
That sounds great. Would have loved to do that myself, but I'm a little bit too old to restart. Those listeners, is it, you know, students, people interested, as we talked about before? So people that want to get in touch with you, will put your reference in the podcast notes, Mehmet Merjan Göz. If you want to hear more from ABB, we haven't talked about Mehmet. We did actually in episode 182, that is, we talked to your, at that time, colleagues, maybe still colleagues, Arzam Kotriwala, Benedikt Schmidt, and John Pretlove. That was about LSTM for ABB's augmented operator. We'll put that in the podcast notes as well. And otherwise, if you, dear listeners, have any questions, comments, please send a short email to peter@aipod.de. Very happy that you stayed with us so far. Looking forward to have you with us again. And Mehmet, thank you very much for the time, for sharing your knowledge, your experience, your thoughts on how we will be moving towards autonomous systems in the process area.
My pleasure, Peter. Thank you for inviting me to this podcast.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.